Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Now, before any of you panic at the thought that that might be the new theme music for The Mind Renewed, or perhaps rejoice at that happy thought, I don't know. Let me make it absolutely clear that that is not the case. It is, in fact, the introductory music to an excellent interview, which we're going to be listening to in a few moments from now. Basically, I just couldn't resist including that music because I thought it was just too wonderfully cheesy to miss. And in fact, I like it so much in a kind of ironic way that we'll probably be hearing it again before the show is out. So as you've probably twigged, this is going to be another one of those what I call guest episodes in which I share something of interest with you during what would otherwise be sheer downtime here at The Mind Renewed. And I do apologise for the fact that the programming here has been somewhat erratic and sparse of late. That's just the way things have gone, really. Just general busyness, etc. But I'm hoping to get back to normal next week, all being well. But, of course, we shall see, because anything can happen. Anyway, before we get underway with that particular interview, I have a few things that I want to say to kind of keep you all up to date with what's going on here in the depths of the Lancashire countryside. So first, we're fully dried out now after our Boxing Day flood. We did get fairly dry quite quickly, but not so that we could redecorate, largely because the plaster was still wet on the walls. But now, after 3 months, it's quite hard to believe it's that long, but yes, after 3 months we are technically dry now. The industrial dehumidifier and fans were removed about a week ago, and the damp levels are back to normal, or what is normal for an early Victorian ex-farm labourer's house with dubious foundations surrounded by fields that are higher than it. So, yeah, far from perfect, but good enough to start redecorating at long last. Second, I want to say a couple of things about the Mind Renewed YouTube channel. Now, some of you may not be aware that TMR actually has a YouTube channel, which is fine. If you don't know, or rather, I suppose you didn't know until I just said that, don't worry, you're not missing anything, because the channel is essentially just another means of getting the same TMR material out there. But there are two things I want to say about the channel. The first thing is, I've had a few people complain about my comments policy on the YouTube channel. The way it reads is this, quote, "Please be aware that if you add comments to this channel that, one, are a little more than graffiti, two, are irrelevant to the video in question, three, use offensive language such as swear words, four, are racist, or five, promote violence, they will be removed. In some cases, if a comment does not allow a reply, it may not be published." Unquote. Now, what some people have said is that I am being hypocritical in defending our right to freedom of speech in my podcasts, as I do, while at the same time not allowing complete freedom of expression on my YouTube channel. I am told by such people that I can't have it both ways. Either I believe in freedom of speech and so should allow anything whatsoever to appear on my channel, or I should acknowledge that by not allowing certain things, I don't believe in freedom of speech. Well, I think this confuses two things. One, our freedom of speech, and two, our freedom to choose whether or not to publish something. I mean, if I was publishing a magazine and I asked for letters from people to put in the latest edition, if someone sent in a letter full of effing and blinding or neo-Nazi drivel or a page full of gibberish, would I really be a hypocrite if I refused to publish that? No, of course I wouldn't. I think it would actually be irresponsible for me to publish that. So why is it any different just because this is YouTube? So what I say to those whose views I choose not to publish is this. Go and set up your YouTube channel, start your own magazine, get a loudhailer or a bullhorn, and say your piece in the streets. I'll probably not like what you say, but I'll defend your right to say it. Meanwhile, please respect my right to publish or not publish as I see fit on my own channel. The second thing is, I've noticed that sometimes other YouTubers will find a TMR interview that they like and think might be helpful for other people to hear, and so they make a copy of the video and post it on their YouTube channel. Now, I'm absolutely fine with that. In fact, I shall say to everybody listening, please do that. But what I would ask, if there happens to be anyone out there doing that or who might consider doing that in future, what I would ask is, please would you credit the Mind Renewed in some way when you redistribute that material, and preferably provide a hyperlink back either to the website or the YouTube channel. And I ask that because in more than a few cases, people have removed all reference to TMR, either by changing the video image that I provided, or I think even worse, by cutting off the beginning of the audio where I say, hello everybody, Julian Charles here with mindrenewed.com, etc., so that nobody can find out about the source of the programme, which I think is actually a bit rude. I mean, as I say, I'm more than happy for people to republish TMR interviews. I encourage that, and thanks to everybody who does do that. But to republish and not acknowledge, I think, is a bit antisocial and a bit dispiriting for me personally when I see that happen. Now, I know that those issues I've just discussed there will not be relevant to the vast majority of you listening out there, but I just wanted to get those off my chest. On a more positive note, let me say thank you to all of you who have sent messages of encouragement. I really do appreciate that. I think sometimes we can get the impression that when a podcast has become a little bit more established, say after 2 or 3 years, then it's just not so important to send messages of appreciation. But I can tell you, it really does make a difference. There are days when I approach the computer thinking, you know, is this really worth bothering with anymore? Is it worth the amount of effort? It'd be just easier, wouldn't it, to hang up the microphone? And then in comes some message of real appreciation, and it does make it all seem worthwhile again. So thank you. A genuine thank you to each and every one of you who has taken the time to do that. And I can honestly say that without you, without your having done that, there's a good chance that TMR would no longer exist. So on to the interview itself. As you know, if you've been listening to The Mind Renewed for a while, I always try to choose something that I think is particularly thought-provoking and relevant to the subjects we cover here. And today is no exception. We're going to be listening to an interview, a rather long interview actually, but I think worth every minute, with Dr. G. William Domhoff, who is a research professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And he is the author of many books and articles on the subject of power structures, particularly in the US. And I think just by mentioning some of the titles of his books, some of which are no doubt considered to be classics by many people, we get a good idea of what his research deals with. We have, for example, from 1967, Who Rules America? The Higher Circles from 1970, Fat Cats and Democrats from 1972, The Bohemian Grove and Other Retreats from 1974, The Powers That Be, 1979, and The Power Elite and the State from 1990, etc., etc. So I think that gives a fair idea. And I did hope, actually, to speak with Dr. Domhoff, but unfortunately, according to his website, he is no longer available for interview, so I didn't pursue that any further. But we do have access to this interview, which is called Who Rules America? And it was part of the Alternative Views Public Affairs Program, founded by Douglas Kellner and Frank Morrow, that produced hundreds of TV shows between 1978 and 1998 with the aim of giving alternative perspectives on things that were not shown by or greatly distorted by the mainstream media. And it was done on virtually a shoestring budget using facilities at Austin Community Television, ACTV, and the University of Texas. And yet they managed to get this show aired really quite widely across the US. And in fact, if you go to archive.org and you search for Alternative Views, you will find over 200 videos from that series posted by the series technical advisor Brian Koenigsdorf, all for free download, and indeed available for responsible reuse under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike license, under which, of course, it appears here today. So many thanks to Frank Morrow, Douglas Kellner, Mike Janowski, and Brian Koenigsdorf for that availability. And there's a lot of good material there. I've not got a long way into looking through that collection, but there's certainly a lot of fascinating material in the collection, so I do recommend people to go and check that out. It's very easy to find. But this two-part interview with William Domhoff, called Who Rules America, as of the title of his 1967 book, I think it's particularly interesting. It is, of course, very much of its time, being recorded in 1986, and specific in its focus, being essentially about power structures in the US. But I think it's actually very useful beyond those confines of time and place, because what William Domhoff does is to give us insight into how power structures work in a particular ostensibly democratic context, how those in elite circles cooperate with each other for similar goals, how they create and manage institutions, how they form interconnections between corporations, foundations, academia, and politics so as to manage as a fairly cohesive class, he says, the core of power in a country while maintaining the appearance of significant democracy for all. And although, as I say, he's talking about the US, I think many of those insights are useful for considering the role of elites in the broader context of what we've been calling the New World Order. And I think this sociological perspective is important because too often I think people find it very difficult to imagine how super elites could be steering. I mean, yeah, okay, the super elite exists, but how could they be steering the world in a desired direction? That just seems very difficult to imagine, and I think is often put down to mere conspiracy theory. But here we have some sociological analysis that I think can at least begin to inform us as to how such power could possibly be wielded on a truly global scale. And as I say, it is specific to its time and place, but there really is much that we can learn from this for our own time and our own increasingly global place. And of course, as I so often say, and it's no different this time, I don't necessarily agree with everything that he says. That's not the point. What I'm doing is presenting it as a useful resource for our thinking. So that's pretty much all I need to say about it, except that the first voice you will hear is that of Frank Morrow, one of the two hosts, the other host being Douglas Kellner. And so here we go with part one of Who Rules America, a conversation with Dr. G. William Domhoff.
If there's one subject that you will not see on the traditional media, particularly television, it's something about the American power structure. Who has power? Who benefits from this? Who controls things, influences things? Well, we have the man with us tonight who knows more about power than anybody else in the country. You may know him by the name of G. William Domhoff from a lot of his books. The first book which he came out with, as far as I know, was C. Wright Mills and the Power Elite. C. Wright Mills was the first one to come up with a comprehensive look at power in the United States in 1956. And then Bill's first big book, comprehensive book, was Who Rules America, which has been read by many, many people, and others such as The Bohemian Grove, The Higher Circles, The Powers That Be, and the most recent one, Who Rules America Now? If you want to find out just who does rule America, and it ain't you and I, well, you want to read that book. I want to, Bill, ask you this first question by using a quote from C. Wright Mills in his book Power Elite or some other book. He said, if somebody starts talking about power and the use of power, you're automatically a muckraker.
Right. Power is a word that Americans are just very uncomfortable with. We're willing to talk about influence, and what we basically like to believe is that individuals and groups can join together to influence specific issues. But power is something that happens in Europe. It's part of the whole American experience to put no emphasis upon the idea of social class and to put no emphasis on the idea of power.
Why do you think this is?
I think that it comes out of the classic liberal tradition and out of American history of rebelling against the king in the American Revolution. And then from there, I think it's because the American experience has been seemingly very individualistic. That is, people have moved across the country. There is evidence of upward mobility. People have become wealthy. They have been able to get education and change their station in life a little bit. And I think that then reinforces this kind of of belief. So that the idea that there is a power structure and a social structure is then something that that we want to ignore. Now, I must say that we know it. We know that there's the other side of the tracks and there's the people that live in the nice houses. We have all of these euphemisms that we use for power structures and for social classes.
What is the dominant view in the universities in the United States of what you call the power structure?
I think the dominant view in the university is something we call pluralism, which says that influence in the United States is exercised by specific individuals who come together as a coalition or an interest group to work on one particular kind of issue. So we always stay at the level of individuals and groups, and we never talk in terms of long-standing institutional structures, which sounds pretty abstract, but that gets down to things like corporations or foundations that for 60 or 80 years have been giving out great amount of money to influence directions that policy take. I think that whole kind of level drops out of our thinking, and I think that our educational system does reinforce that.
And what led you to take this different approach to power? Why did you become dissatisfied with the pluralist approach and start looking at the power structure in different terms?
I think that for me it was probably because of many of the events of the 1960s when people tried to exercise their rights, such as in the civil rights movement or such as in the anti-war movement of the time, or even in some of the attempts by consumer advocates such as Ralph Nader. Basically, when they seem to be meeting a stone wall, then you kind of think there may be something else more there. I like what Ralph Nader said in regard to your question. That he said is that if you want to find out about the power structure, you got to go out there and kind of bump up against it. The way you find it's there is when you hit these brick walls. And as I saw that happening, I got more interested in trying to see if there was this class and institutional structure. And basically, I started out in a good old American way by trying to trace individuals in their activities. And what I found standing behind these individuals, I believe, are large corporations, large foundations, a series of research institutes, a series of policy discussion groups that make it so that a David Rockefeller is not merely an individual, but is in fact constantly involved, whether it's with a bank or his foundation or policy discussion group like the Council on Foreign Relations. And then one begins to see that there's an ongoing institutional structure. And so that even then, when David Rockefeller retires, you see that the people that now run Chase Manhattan Bank, that now are the directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, continue to be the people that run the country. So that when you get a little time perspective on it, you start to see the individuals change a little bit, but that they come from the same social background and they come from the same large institutions. So I tried then to find that structure that stood behind our individual actions.
Well, let's take a look at this. And for, I guess we should start with the class structure and class nature of the United States. Now, we hear about middle class very frequently. It's written, a lot of things are studied about the middle class, and a lot of things have been written about the middle class. You see frequently lower middle class and lower, but you don't see too much written about upper class. Now, if there's a middle class, there has to be an upper, right? Okay.
I think that there very definitely is an upper class in the United States, and indeed, that's been the starting point of my research, is to start with social clubs, exclusive private schools, summer resorts, to start with what we can see if we will but look, to see these people as a set of interacting and intermarrying set of families who have developed a whole set of social institutions that preserve their way of life. Once we have located these various schools, clubs, resorts, retreats, debutante balls, then we can understand the historical continuity of social upper class in America. It's my belief that about 0.5% of Americans are part of what I would call a social upper class. And these people own about 20 to 25% of all the privately held wealth in the United States. That is, if we took all of your wealth, which might be your car, your house, your insurance policy, if we threw in your guitar, everything, if we took all of that wealth plus the stocks and bonds and real estate in America, we put all that in a big pile, 20 to 25% of all of that, 0.5% of the people have that in the United States. And what my thesis basically says is that those people that have that 20 to 25% of all the privately held wealth are not mere individuals that are scattered here and there and are kind of rare and don't know each other, but in fact they are closely knit. They know each other, they see the world the same way, they do discuss with each other the kinds of policies that they think would further their way of life. So in that sense, we then talk about them in this more sociological abstract sense, that they're not just families, because in fact there are these ongoing institutional kinds of structures, and they are structures that do matter, and they make a difference to a lot of Americans as they attempt to emulate these people, as they attempt to become part of these institutions and so on.
Now, I under this, their institutions and their structures do two things, or three. They perpetuate themselves. They exclude other people. They have mechanisms to exclude other people from joining them.
Absolutely.
But they also, they use the mechanisms to bring up new blood when they think these people have the right credentials.
Right. I think one of the most dramatic examples that I know of that, Frank, concerns the way in which moderate members of the upper class responded to the civil rights movement of the 60s and the rebellions that were going on in the inner cities, in the ghettos at that time. And that was that a number of these institutions of which we're talking decided that they really had to find the best and the brightest of the black community and to educate them so they could be more a part of the corporate structure. And what they simply did was to get money from the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations and a couple others, and then to go to leading private schools and say, we want to create a scholarship program for black students. And this program is called ABC, A Better Chance. And literally, over the space then of 10 or 15 years, many thousands of young black students were taken into these prep schools, and then from there went on to major colleges and universities with fellowships. And these people are now out there in their 30s, being in the media, being in corporate law, working for corporations. We've interviewed some of these people, and it's very fascinating the way, and it shows you so nicely about class, because these people gradually take on the style and manner of the school of which they were a part. And they tell us, it's very funny, that they'll go home and people say, you're starting to talk different. And they say, you know, it's, I go and I like to visit my family, but my other friends, I don't have anything in common with them anymore. And that's what we mean, you see, by then a social class. If one has read all about American history and knows about various kinds of arts that most people don't know about, if you've had European vacations, then you want to talk to other people that can talk your language. And gradually then these people come to feel different from the very group that they originally came from. I use this example because I think it is so dramatic in the sense that we're taking very poor people out of a ghetto and taking them to this private school where they're one of two or three or four black people.
At what age, by the way?
Oh, 14, 15, 16. Uh-huh. And making them part of this class in the sense of putting them there, and then they gradually, just out of human processes of while you're at school, you certainly want to relate to other people, you want to get along, and before you know it, you're like the people that you're going to school with.
It's socialization. I mean, that's
right,
the process.
Exactly.
Are these people intermarrying with their white social upper class people, or do they bring black women into this program as well?
There are black women in the program as well. And I don't know the answer to that question in terms of any systematic data yet. We've only interviewed a few mm-hmm. of the people, but definitely then there is some intermarriage.
I guess the next big question then, there is this upper class in the United States. Is it a ruling class, a governing class?
And is it cohesive?
Yeah, I believe that first it is cohesive, and secondly that it is a ruling class. I think that we see the cohesion in the fact that these people are members of each other's clubs, so to speak. That is, if we look at club memberships all over the United States, we would find that a leading banker in New York may well be in clubs in Los Angeles and San Francisco. We find in the case of a club I've studied with some care called the Bohemian Club in San Francisco that people from all of the United States come to its two-week retreat in the last part of July and sleep together in tents and huts and teepees and just kind of go to summer camp together. They literally do go to summer camp together. There's a lot of that kind of social cohesiveness. There's also cohesiveness in the corporate world in that they sit on each other's corporate boards. So that the head of Chase Manhattan Bank, such as David Rockefeller until recent years, will sit on two or three other corporation boards. But the head of those corporations will also sit on the board of Chase Manhattan Bank. So they take in each other's laundry at the economic level as well. They also come together to talk about more general issues, whether it's foreign policy or kinds of domestic policy, at what I call discussion groups. But this means organizations like the Committee for Economic Development, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Conference Board, the Business Council. There's numerous of these groups. So I think there is cohesiveness in this group as a social class and in terms of its economic interest.
We've been talking a lot or referring to the Council on Foreign Relations, Committee for Economic Development, Trilateral Commission. Let's talk in greater detail about the policy planning mechanisms, some of these organizations that we've been talking about, because I think this is probably the thing that people know least about. You don't find them in history books, and you don't find them in economics textbooks and all. Mm-hmm. Tell us about these.
Basically, these organizations were all created at different times in the 20th century in the face of particular problems that were faced by the corporate community. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Council on Foreign Relations, it was formed shortly after World War I when statespeople came and corporate leaders came back from Versailles. And they said, we have to have a better perspective on foreign relations now that we're clearly going to be the dominant power in the world. And they created this discussion group in order to make themselves more sophisticated about these issues. These organizations are funded by large corporations and by foundations. They then bring together these business people for discussions with academic experts. These academic experts are basically housed at institutes on major campuses, the Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, Berkeley, MIT, Caltech nexus. And these experts are also housed at think tanks, like the RAND Corporation and various institutes for strategic thinking here, there, and everywhere. So what we have at a policy discussion group is the bringing together of a variety of academic opinions with this range of corporate leaders. And they then discuss a particular issue, as I say, a foreign policy issue, a monetary policy issue, a particular domestic issue. And they try to work out ideas that make sense to all of them. Now, from the corporate point of view, by listening, say they got a liberal academic and a more conservative academic in the same room, and they listen to you guys argue, and then they see what makes sense in terms of their view of the world.
And interest, economic
right.
and social. Mm-hmm.
So then in that situation, now, beyond then becoming sophisticated about policies, they also, you see, are looking at each other in terms of who can do this more general kind of task, meaning this, and I think we've all seen it in our lives. We have friends that might be very good at their particular job. They might be very good, say, at running a business. But if you ask them to do a more general thing, like be on the city council, they maybe don't do very well because they don't relate well to other groups. We see this with faculty people, people that do a fine job in their department. But maybe you wouldn't want them on a general committee of the faculty because they're impatient with student demands. Or they get angry with the administration. So we say, we don't want to put that person on that mm-hmm. committee. So what they do is informally learn about each other's leadership capability. But what that's one thing that's learned at these organizations. But the other thing it's learned is which academic expert makes sense to me and can I personally relate to. So it's at these organizations that you meet somebody like a Henry Kissinger and you say, he not only makes sense, but I get along with him personally. So you develop then this relationship between the corporate community and the expert community at these organizations. So they are a place where these people get a more general view, where they get sophisticated, where they informally select each other as leaders, where they inject academic opinion into their perspectives, where they look academic experts over to become potential advisors in the government. And then, and very importantly, what these organizations do is they legitimate these people as fair-minded experts. You see, the interesting thing about politics in America in terms of policies as opposed to electing individuals is that the political organizations of the ruling class are not called political. Now, is this an irony? Yeah, in a way. That is, all the groups in America that are called nonpartisan, bipartisan, nonpolitical, that's the political organizations of the ruling class in America. You see, if you go out and say, I don't understand how you can talk about a ruling class. There's the Democrats over here and there's the Republicans over here. That's politics, isn't it? No, that's just deciding which individuals will fill offices. Politics in the important sense of which policies we all agree make sense, that happens in non-political organizations. So when the Committee for Economic Development puts out a statement, it says, the Committee for Economic Development, a nonpartisan group of business people, today suggested we alter the Social Security system in the following way. And then they say, look, some of our members are Democrats, some of our members are Republicans. We're trying to get something that's good for all of America. We're trying to transcend politics. We're trying to do something that's in the national interest. Now, once you say, yeah, that's fair, we got to get beyond this fight between Republicans and Democrats. They're people that they can run an organization, their success in America. And then we identify with them because of their high status and because they're part of this fair-minded organization. Academic experts from Harvard have helped them and from Yale. And who are we, you know, to argue with somebody from Harvard and Yale, plus a successful business leader? And that's what we call legitimation. In my mind, of their policies. And we respect them. I know that because when I go around and talk about these things or debate these things and so on, many times people will stand up afterwards and they'll say, hey, why shouldn't the man from General Motors run the country? He's a winner. He's shown, like Iacocca, they're talking about Iacocca should be president, right? Mm-hmm. Well, look at him. He's a wonderful guy. He's proven it. He's run these corporations. What do you want for nothing? In other words, that has made him somebody that Americans will accept and relate to, and they'll go along with those policies. So that's a role, then, to come back to these organizations that they play, this kind of legitimation of policies that are in the general interest of the ruling class and are labeled nonpartisan.
And then these policies not only are put into effect, but also the people from these organizations are placed in positions of decision-making power in the government.
Right. And I think that the policies, incidentally, to be a little academic about it, I think that the policies could be implemented without necessarily putting the people in government. But it's the fact that the people that go into government, that's what we can see most clearly, and that's what people can kind of relate to or identify with. They can see what you're talking about if you show the movement of Donald Regan from Merrill Lynch to the Business Roundtable to government. And then if you say the same thing happens under Democrats, or if you show the movement of Henry Kissinger from Harvard to the Council on Foreign Relations to the paid staff of Nelson Rockefeller, and then finally to the government under Nixon, then we can see that what's happening. It might be that a lot of times that important policies come out of these organizations without necessarily the particular person coming to government. Incidentally, to put this then at a level of persons again, from the point of view of these academic experts, what they're trying to do is to attach themselves to somebody that they think is going to be successful. Because the culmination of an academic expert's career is to be a Henry Kissinger. And when I say that, I'm thinking of Brzezinski. Brzezinski was always sort of in the shadow of Kissinger. But he was always in these discussion groups I'm talking about. He headed an important think tank at Columbia, and he was always in Council on Foreign Relations Study Group. Well, David Rockefeller asked Brzezinski to head up the staff for this organization called the Trilateral Commission, which is a discussion group of prominent leaders from the Western European nations plus Japan plus the United States. Incidentally, they're all people, all these countries have a Council on Foreign Relations, and they're basically people from the National Council on Foreign Relations. David Rockefeller asked Brzezinski to head this, the staff for this new discussion group that started in the 70s. And when the man from Coca-Cola suggested to David Rockefeller that Jimmy Carter be a part of that group, Brzezinski met Carter at the at the Trilateral Commission. Now, from Brzezinski's point of view, he looked and he said, this guy might make it to president. I'm going to bet on him, in effect. And the result will be I get to be a national security advisor someday. So there is that whole subjective part of what the academic is doing there in terms of, this is a guy I can relate to, and I think he's going to be a winner. So I could explain all of what I've been talking about from a subjective careerist point of view for an individual like a Kissinger or a Brzezinski. But my point is, you see, a lot of them have bet on the wrong guy. That is, they decided they were going to work for George Romney. Well, who remembers George Romney, you know? Or they decided they were going to work for some particular Democrat that lost out somewhere, made a fatal faux pas. And so we don't hear of them, but they probably maybe had some important policy inputs, but they themselves did not arrive in the government because they bet on the wrong political horse.
So what these organizations do is to very much limit the range of policies that is even discussable.
That's right.
And
they,
what is legitimated in the minds of the American people, and also in Congress.
That's right.
But there's a parallel thing that goes on in public opinion shaping too, is there not?
I think so, and I think the important thing to say is precisely what you just did, and that is, it's not that these people sort of just pour opinions into our head, but rather that they try to manage the limits of respectable opinion, which are fairly wide as those things go in the world, but nonetheless, kinds of liberal opinions and kinds of ultra-conservative opinions get labeled in some way as too utopian or too kooky or un-American.
And or too extreme or too radical.
Right, and we can, the way the ultra-conservatives do it is to call it communist or socialist or un-American. The moderates say, sounds awfully utopian to me. Or it sounds awfully academic. I mean, the appeal is to the practical. If we can legitimate something as practical and American, then it's okay. But very definitely, there's a constant argument that goes on to try to keep some opinions not respectable. And to see that, you have to look historically at some particular argument. And here I just say quickly that the best example of that involves the famous economist John Maynard Keynes and his views about the use of government spending to stabilize a capitalist economy. There are many ways of being, there are many policies that follow from Keynes. There are many different things you could do and be a Keynesian. But what happened in America from 1935 to 1965 was essentially an intellectual struggle in which the business community saw that a very conservative Keynesianism would make sense to them, but that a more liberal Keynesianism they didn't want to accept, and furthermore weren't forced to accept because our working class is not powerful enough organizationally to force a liberal kind of Keynesianism such as happens in Sweden, say. So basically what Keynes said in the middle 30s slowly got whittled down just the way you described, got whittled down, and so we have a very conservative kind of Keynesianism. And now, right now, in America, we are seeing the amazing thing, whether intentionally or not, we are seeing the amazing and complete application of Keynesian economics to the American economy by somebody who, A, totally rejects Keynes and claims he's a supply-sider, and C, doesn't understand economics, and this is Ronald Reagan. But what has happened is that we've just had a total Keynesian recovery in the United States, because the key thing in Keynes is you run a deficit and you do government spending. Now, that's what Ronald Reagan has done, but it's all, of course, been military spending, and we call it a military Keynesianism. Ronald Reagan is behaving as a Keynesian even while saying he's not. And he may not know he's a Keynesian. I don't know with him. You know, you never know. So there are a whole set of mechanisms that legitimate some opinions and make other opinions seem far out or not worth studying.
Bill, the mass media do this too. My studies of the mass media, I find that once this policy has been set, that the media will follow up on this, and you will not find any discussion on anything on the other side of this preset agenda by these people you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Or if it is discussed, it's highly criticized, but generally it's just ignored. Yeah. Isn't there another aspect of determining whether a ruling class is also a governing class? Or the upper class is also a ruling class, and that is you have to look at where the decision makers come from to see if the prime decision makers come from this ruling class or the people whom this ruling class is selected to work.
I think that that's another very useful way of understanding about power because it's the most visible to us. That is, we can watch people. We don't know what's being talked about and said usually at the National Security Council or in the private meetings in the White House. But we sure do know who's there. And to give you an example, if we take the Secretary of Treasury as an important position, and we look at a few of them. For instance, under Kennedy, who ran on a platform of getting the country moving again, we've got to get beyond this stodgy Republican establishment and so on. And yet when he was elected, the person he put in charge of Treasury was a man named C. Douglas Dillon, from a man worth several hundreds of millions of dollars, who from a major investment house in New York. When we jump to Jimmy Carter, who was our populist, and Hamilton Jordan assured us that we were going to see new faces, in fact, the person that we got as our Secretary of Treasury was a man named W. Michael Blumenthal, who was the head of Bendix Corporation, a trustee of the Council on Foreign Relations, a trustee of the Committee for Economic Development, a trustee of Princeton University, and a member of the Trilateral Commission, and he becomes our Secretary of Treasury. Now, Ronald Reagan comes in, and he's going to get rid of the mess in Washington from a neoconservative perspective, but our Secretary of Treasury is a man named Donald Regan, or was. It was his first Secretary of Treasury, as you know, and Donald Regan was from Merrill Lynch. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a trustee of the Committee for Economic Development. He was a trustee of the Business Roundtable. And what I'm saying, of course, with those examples is that when we look at the cabinet-level appointments of the past 40 years, at the least, but we could go back further. But if we look at the last 40 years, that whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, whether it's a populist or a neoconservative, whatever particular ticket they run on or ideology they run on in order to attract a coalition of voters, when they turn to the question of governing, when they turn to the question of how are they going to implement a set of policies, they do, as your question suggests, they turn to the same group of people that have been both made sophisticated about issues in these policy discussion groups and have been made legitimate in these policy discussion groups as having more than just the perspective of their particular corporation, but also that they are statespersons. That is, that they are people that look at the broader picture. So the continuity of these people is very great. I also want to add to that, Frank, now that you got me kind of rolling on it, is that this also involves experts in America, not just multi-millionaires and corporate executives, but very important experts are part of this power elite that we're talking about as well. And what I'm then saying is that councils on foreign relations, committees for economic development, and so on, actually have basically a monopoly of the respectable expertise in the United States. The people that are sound and sensible.
These are all in quotes, respectable,
right,
sound.
Henry
sensible.
Kissinger being one example.
And that's exactly where I'm headed, sound. Is to Henry Kissinger. Yeah. If we look at the career of Henry Kissinger, we might say, well, only in America. in one way, yes, because here is a person who's a escapee from Nazi Germany, who by going to school here, by doing well at Harvard, we can say, look at him, he's been very important, and he has. But here is the other part of Kissinger's career that's so important. While he was at Harvard, He was seen by a man named McGeorge Bundy, who was the dean of the faculty, or the head of the faculty, and from a prominent Boston family. His father is a corporation lawyer. In other words, he's a well-to-do person that happened to be in the academic world. And he called his friends at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he said, you know, this guy Kissinger is a bright young guy, and he could really be useful in some of the discussion groups. And so Kissinger was invited to be in these discussion groups, and Nelson Rockefeller was really taken with Kissinger, and he basically then hired him to write things for him and to write things for panels of experts that the Rockefellers set up. Well, in the late 60s, the interesting thing is that, of course, that Richard Nixon appointed Kissinger as his foreign policy advisor. Now, the first reason that's interesting is that supposedly Nixon and Nixon and Rockefeller were so different, they had all their political conflicts, and yet Nixon was perfectly willing to hire what seemed to be, quote, Nelson Rockefeller's man. But beyond that, the interesting thing is that 2 years after the election, at a point when Kissinger's star was quite high, Hubert Humphrey was interviewed. They were talking about what he would have done if he was president. And he said, well, it's funny. He said, one of the things I was going to do was appoint Henry Kissinger. He had talked to Henry Kissinger before the election saying, if I'm elected, will you be my foreign policy advisor? My point is, of course, whether we get Nixon or whether we get Humphrey, there was one thing we were sure we were going to get, and that was Kissinger.
He was the Rockefeller man.
Basically, by that time, of course, he's known to many of these corporate people. His expertise is very useful to them. He's been legitimated through being part of these organizations like the Council. But then let's take it down to what I think's also interesting in terms of the continuity of a power structure. Let's take it down to the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, in part, ran on a platform that was practically running against Henry Kissinger. One of the things the very conservative Republicans do not like is what they call the Eastern Establishment, and one of their favorite pet peeves within the Eastern Establishment is the Council on Foreign Relations, and one part of that is Henry Kissinger. Well, what do we end up with, though? Within a year or two, we have Henry Kissinger as head of the President's Commission on Central America. In other words, Ronald Reagan also then hires Henry Kissinger. So when you just trace the career of that man, you then see the continuity in the power structure. But at the same time, we're back to our earlier point about, are we just talking about individuals? No, we're not, because we have to understand that Kissinger first was at a very important institution called Harvard, which is one of the main reservoirs of expertise, as well as a place for upward mobility, where experts are seen by members of the ruling class, whether they're McGeorge Bundy or whether they're trustees of the university. Then he went to the Council on Foreign Relations, where he was part of a discussion group of 20 or 30 people from all over the country, people from the CIA, people from the State Department, people from corporations, people from law firms, other academic experts. And in that situation, they say, this person sees the world the way we do, and he has information that's very useful to us. And so it's this institutional setting that he's moved through that brings him into the power structure.
Bill, could we move now to the economic foundation of this power structure?
Well, I think that, in a simple phrase, they are the owners and managers of large corporations and banks. I think that the base of power, there are two key bases of power in the United States. One is a large corporation, and the second is the federal government in Washington. When I talk, for instance, about a Council on Foreign Relations, Council on Foreign Relations is not a place of power. It is a place where powerful people discuss. When I talk about the Bohemian Club and its Bohemian Grove retreat in Northern California, the Bohemian Grove is not a place of power. You are not powerful because you were at the Bohemian Grove. You're at the Bohemian Grove because you were powerful, and you are powerful because you're an owner and manager of a large corporation. So that's the root of the power in the United States. There is what I call a corporate community, which means that the large corporations in America are interconnected through ownership, through sharing of information, through putting out products together, through having the same directors, through hiring each other's managers, that it truly is, in that sense, a community. And they are relatively tightly knit. They not only share then a common interest in making a lot of money, but they also believe they have common enemies, which is very important in making a community too. And their common enemies are environmentalists, labor, and of course those dreadful bureaucrats in Washington who in the American ideology are constantly harassing these poor, beleaguered entrepreneurs who are just struggling to deliver jobs for us.
To make the $3 billion.
Yeah. So I think then when we say, when you see that they, and we do know this from interviews, that they see themselves constantly under pressure from, as I say, labor, environmentalists, and from government trying to regulate them, that gives them a feeling of we against them. But more than that, they're not just, I don't just have, you know, one corporation and somebody else another one. We share that corporation. We have share it in ownership. We share it in directorship, and so on. So I do think that is the base of power in the United States, Doug. And that is something that people really don't like to say. That is, they want to see power in individuals and not in General Motors and General Electric and Exxon and Chase Manhattan Bank. But actually, that's where I think the power is. Then from there, people like Henry Kissinger become very important to articulate the general policies that those people need to continue. The corporate community does develop a set of generalists. Maybe a person, maybe for instance, you start out running a particular corporation. You're doing a fine job. And you're asked to be on a couple or three other corporate boards. And from being on all those different corporate boards, you start to see the bigger picture. And now people say, Frank, would you go to Washington and testify and try to explain to these government officials what we need? You become a generalist for the corporations as a whole. And you may leave your particular job in any one corporation, but you're still part of the corporate community. You're not some individual floating around out there. You have an institutional base. You have a reference group in this corporate community.
That's right. So many people are from the Bechtel Corporation or in the Reagan administration, Secretary of State, mm-hmm. the Secretary of
Defense,
right, and a couple of others. Yeah. And certainly they haven't lost their loyalty to the Bechtel Corporation. The Bechtel Corporation is doing really well with the government contracts. Yeah. I want to ask you this. This seems like a contradiction in a way. On one hand, we say that the government is dominated or controlled by the wealthy, powerful people from the American ruling class. But on the other hand, we see that the business community grouses a lot about the bureaucrats in Washington now. Are they grousing and complaining about their own people and the way they run the government? Or is it like a couple of books I've seen where it's the inside directors, the managers of these corporations who have basically their one corporation uppermost in mind, complaining about the way their betters, the ruling class in Washington, is running the country for the benefit of themselves and the country. Mm-hmm. So you see this division at the absolutely highest level compared to the highest level of just merely one corporation. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really complex and important question, because it does seem to be an anomaly that businessmen say that they're powerless, and yet they have all of this money, they're the ones appointed to government and so on. So why is it that businessmen say they are powerless? I've thought about that a lot and read a lot about it and interviewed people, and I think that it has several levels to it as an answer. First of all, we have to start with the fact that all Americans tend to have the view that government is awful and rapacious. It's like, that's what we always complain about. That's just sort of the way we talk. For instance, in the Reagan administration, they're constantly talking against big government, constantly complaining about government, and yet they're constantly getting all of these subsidies and being, you know, using the government in ways that's useful to them. So in one way, in one part of it, the answer is that it's just part of our rhetoric in America. But at the next level, And this analysis comes from a political scientist who does not think there's a cohesive power elite, a man named Grant McConnell. He makes the point that by constantly criticizing these government officials, it keeps them on the defensive. You see, so it's a very good strategy if I walk in and I say, Doug, you're against me, aren't you? And they say, no, Bill, I'm not against you. Doug, you're always against me. You always seem to be not doing the stuff that really helps our corporation. This constant complaining about government keeps the government people kind of on the defensive and proving that they're all right. One of the best things that Kennedy ever did from the point of view of the business community was during his argument with the steel companies over price rise that they did, he made a comment to somebody, my father always told me businessmen were sons of Well, they constantly then used that on Kennedy, and he constantly had to prove that he was okay. And there's a wonderful book on the free enterprisers that points out that corporations did fantastically well under Kennedy. So it's, I think it's useful to do that. Now, but there's another level, and that is, you see, in the American government, the people that are the day-to-day employees do come from the middle levels of our society. The values of our country are such that it's no great individual fulfillment to become a government official because we look down on government so much. They're just politicians and bureaucrats. If this were a European country with an aristocratic tradition, members of the upper class might say, gee, I think I'll go into the civil service, they would say, and say, I'm thinking concretely here of England and of France, so that there might be many people in the government as permanent employees who were from the same class as the business people. But in America, that wouldn't be something you would do. If you had lots of money, you went to this nice prep school, now you've got this Yale degree, and you say, what am I going to do with my life? You're not going to say, oh, I'm going to go work for the government, unless it's the State Department. And there's some tradition of some upper class involvement. So they aren't part of the same networks. And in that sense, there's always the possibility that these government bureaucrats might, we don't quite know them, so we don't maybe quite, you see, then trust them. There's that.
There's also residual idealism in the country at different times in history, during the New Deal, during Kennedy in the 1960s. A lot of people were influenced to believe that we needed a stronger government, that the government should serve the people. There's a populist tradition in the United States. And so some government, quote-unquote, bureaucrats, we might say employees, have assimilated these beliefs that puts them in conflict with corporate power. There's also an anti-corporate tradition in the United States. It's not that everyone emulates and celebrates and goes along with
That's
the corporations.
Absolutely true.
The reason I think your books have had impact in some quarters is because they have played to this distrust of excessive corporate power. And so you get this at times operative in the government where there actually are conflicts between the state and the government. And there is a relative autonomy to some of the government regulatory agencies. Mostly they're packed by people from business sharing the interests of business. But occasionally you'll get a Nicholas Johnson in the FCC, who really believes that the media should be ruled in the common interest and will go against the networks. So you get this kind of contradiction.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's by looking precisely at cases like the one you just named, or if we looked at the Federal Trade Commission in the late 70s when Michael Perchik took it over, and he started to really use it to try to enforce various kinds of laws and regulations on the corporations, and they fought back against the FCC. But Doug, I think you're absolutely right. I think that is the final level of understanding businessmen's concerns and feeling of powerlessness. And that's precisely the point that because Americans believe that government is potentially bad and domineering, and because of the populist democratic tradition of America, basically, it says our government, you see, is founded on all the people. Governments in the past were founded on divinities or on kings, or the parliament founded a government, but ours clearly says power is in the people. And what that means is that in any American business person dominating that government, there's a certain way in which it's illegitimate. And the final point, then, that we think we pick up in interviews and A couple people have written about this, even for the 1920s, which we all assume was the heyday of business. There was always that fear that you, I think that you well put, that namely, the people might take over this government. So in that sense, it's not theirs in the legitimacy sense. And so there's always that concern with the underlying populist kind of thing, and it does manifest itself sometimes then in the election of liberal people, and then in the appointment of liberal officials. And you know, when we were talking earlier about campaign finance, and I was talking about people that rose to the heights in terms of running for president, running for vice president, it is also the case. We can see it. We can all name some that there are elected officials in the United States who are not part of the power elite, and they very often do oppose their positions. So I have no doubt there are pro-labor, there are pro-environmental, there are very liberal elected officials at various levels in our society, and that does create then real conflict. So that my point would be, it's not that there aren't such people there. My point is, they usually lose, just as you say. With, I mean, in effect, if we look at the FCC, or if we look at the FTC, if we look at various kinds of attempts to create, for instance, a consumer protection agency with some teeth, but what happens is we eventually lose. They grind us down, and they grind us down because they have this institutional base behind them. They have more staying power, and furthermore, eventually, with these liberal elected officials, they constantly run at these people. One of the things that's so interesting to me is to watch the way in which a liberal politician will come to Congress, and if he or she starts to really vote in a way that's constantly annoying to the business community, they will, quote, target that person. They will constantly send a lot of money to candidates that are running against this person in the district. So keeping the person on the defensive, letting them know that one false step and they're going to eliminate them. So, you see, my view is not of a power structure that's sort of sitting there and it's all signed, sealed, and delivered and never challenged. In America, the power structure is constantly challenged, but it basically constantly wins, except on, you know, occasionally it doesn't. But so there is real conflict in America, and I think your point really brings that out well. And I think that it's important not to deny that, but it's important to see who wins.
That's the key to this, is that we do have a pluralistic society, but we do not have a pluralistic economic and political structure.
I think that's excellent. I think that we have the paradox over the last 20 years that a lot of the social movements that have happened, a lot of the events have made in some ways this a very open society at the individual, personal a kind of level, and yet I continue to believe we have the same corporate power structure. And I don't think it's necessarily a contradiction in terms that my access to certain kind of information, my right to do things as an individual, which is a very important part of liberalism, that could be increased in the society, and it has been for minorities, for women, for gays, for handicapped. Those kinds of liberal individual freedoms could actually be in some way increased, and we could still be relatively powerless.
So that is the end of part one of this interview with Dr. William Domhoff. And as it's in two parts, that does give us the opportunity to reflect for a moment on what's been said. And as we reflect, we shall listen, and I'm afraid I just couldn't resist doing this, we shall listen again to the introductory music that opens part two.
When we talk about whether a group is ruling or not, we have to look at three or four indicators of power. One, of course, is we've hit upon when we talked about wealth. If a group is a dominant group or a ruling group, we would expect them to have more of what people value in a society. And certainly this upper social class we've been talking about has more wealth, it has more income, it certainly has access to the best education and health care and so on. So on all the measures of who benefits, I think that shows that they are a ruling class. Because we would all like to be a lot richer, we'd all like to be a lot more secure in our economic circumstance. But I also think that we can show that these people are a ruling class when we look at the kinds of policies that are implemented by the federal government. And these policies range from subsidies for specific corporations and industries, tax breaks, a little shaving on regulations, mm-hmm. and so on up to more general policies. Policies that I think basically benefit large corporations as a group. And that means kinds of foreign policies that maximize the possibility of investment overseas, policies at the domestic level that maximize the possibility of a tranquil and happy and docile workforce, numerous kinds of policy. I also think that if we look at the history of any politician in America that rises to the very top, that what we find is that at a certain point in their career, they become very involved with the people that we're talking about here, and that the upper class becomes essential to that politician in terms of the financing of his or her campaigns. And that means things like financing their travel, giving them money in advance so they can schedule all their television time, giving them the kind of money that allows them to hire experts. And basically then it gives any politician that gets involved with these people a leg up in any particular political race. And these politicians are not going to have a set of policy stances that are going to be inimical to the ruling group.
Jimmy Carter is a perfect example.
Jimmy Carter is a fine example, and we could say that he's a nice example in terms of the fact that it was not really until he got to the state level that he got involved with the well-to-do of Atlanta, and then some well-to-do people in Atlanta thought that he might be potentially a national level politician and got him involved with the Trilateral Commission, where he met a lot of people who in turn national elites that gave him a lot of money. But if we look at Nixon's another kind of interesting example, in that well-to-do Republicans in the Los Angeles area were looking for a candidate to challenge a liberal in Congress. And they interviewed, literally put out the word that they wanted to interview candidates. And they decided on Nixon, and they bankrolled Nixon from that point forward. But let's take Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey was a liberal person who, I think in early parts of his career, was not heavily involved with the people I'm talking about. But once he wanted to go beyond the state level, it's real clear in terms of his campaign finance that he was involved with a relative handful of people that in 1968, for instance, lent him, 20, 25 people lent him a couple million dollars for his campaign. So, as I say, you can look at the liberals, or you can look at Ronald Reagan, you can look at Nixon, you can look at Carter, and as they, when they decide they want to go beyond a local or state level milieu, they get involved with the people we're talking about.
They have to, otherwise they can't, they don't have the financial
backing. They just don't have the financial backing. It's like thinking of politics as this real high stakes poker game that you have to have a few million dollars to be in it. And you see, this is where we get back to this question about, is there a power structure? Americans are used to thinking, well, if there's a power structure, we wouldn't even be allowed to be in politics. But in America, you're allowed to run for president. You can run for anything you want. There's just one thing. You better have several million dollars or access to people that have several million dollars. So you see, we can say on the one hand, well, it's very fair. Anybody can run. But, in fact, not anybody can when you get down to the specifics of the matter. So we have a formally open and liberal system, but in practice, the way things work out is that the rich get richer, and they are able to continue a set of policies that that maximize their advantages.
So far, you've talked about a cohesion
right.
within the ruling class, but aren't there significant conflicts mm-hmm. at times? The Vietnam War, for instance, there were two opposing views where people, the establishment, mm-hmm. took pro and anti-war positions. I think in Reagan's income tax reform, obviously there's no cohesion or they can't come to mm-hmm. agreement. How do you explain conflicts within the ruling class? What are the main divisions, mm-hmm. if any?
Okay.
And what forms do they take?
Okay. Once we have set this general kind of framework mm-hmm. that we've been talking about, in which we in effect know that these corporate people feel a lot of commonness. From there, we can go on to say that they do argue about various kinds of things, and that I do think that we see some relatively long-lasting kinds of differences of opinions over specific kinds of issues. And you mentioned the division of opinion that developed over the Vietnam War, which I think was very real and very important. At the same time, from my point of view, the debate over what to do went on in precisely the organizations we're talking about. That is, put more specifically, in the early 60s, I think there was complete consensus in the power elite that it was necessary to go into Vietnam. As the war went more and more badly, real significant differences of opinion developed in the late 60s, particularly in the face of the Tet Offensive. And this manifested itself then in very vehement arguments at a place like the Council on Foreign Relations. And experts came there, for instance, one person, Samuel Huntington from Harvard, and he would say to the discussion groups things like this. He said, look, things have changed. We've got to look at this differently. First of all, there's a Sino-Soviet split. Second, there's no big communist party now in Indonesia. That's been wiped out, and that makes less of a threat in Southeast Asia in general. Thirdly, there hasn't been the spread of the Cuban Revolution in Latin America. And then fourthly, we're now facing a major ghetto uprising in this country. Real unsettling things are happening.
And the peace movement,
too. And the peace movement is the next thing. Yeah. Faced with this, and given what it's going to cost us to win in Vietnam, we should get out of that war gradually. Now, what's interesting is that a set of people that were known around Washington as the wise men, these were people that Johnson brought in once a month, the wise men switched their views on the war. Well, there were about a dozen of them. Ten of them, at least, were in this Council on Foreign Relations. Three investment bankers, three corporate lawyers, a couple retired military, all had been in and out of government, in and out of corporations, and they said that they heard all the government officials talk about what was needed after Tet, and they went to Johnson and they said to him, "Don't send more troops to Vietnam." According to all accounts, he was kind of stunned by this. And 1 week later, he went on the TV, and he announced he would not run for president again. And that was kind of a crucial kind of turning point. Definitely a division of opinion developed on how to deal with this situation. They changed their mind. Now, there are also longer-lasting kinds of divisions of opinion between people that, in terms of the American political spectrum, that we would call moderate kinds of conservatives. They are either conservative Democrats or moderate Republicans. Their opinions differ from those of very conservative people, sometimes called ultra-conservative. The moderate conservatives come, I believe, from the biggest and most international corporations in America, by and large. These corporations are in favor of more and more free trade. They are willing to see some kinds of social welfare policies used. They believe that there is some validity to a Keynesian economics. The ultra-conservative people tend to come from smaller corporations and privately held corporations, that is, where the family owns it and the stock is not publicly traded. And they tend to be in very competitive kinds of national markets, that they sell their products in some region of America and aren't trying to get overseas or don't have the money to get overseas. Those people have been historically very isolationist on foreign policy. They have been opposed to the slightest welfare state developments, including Social Security. And these people tend to believe that a deficit in spending is the work of the devil.
Also very anti-labor, too, against any concessions to labor, whereas the more moderates are willing to bring them in, or at least the conservative labor.
Some of them, yeah. I think there, I want to say that I think I was a little wrong in some things that I wrote in the early 70s, particularly in 1970. I had the understanding from my earlier work that that the people I've just described as moderates were moderates towards unions. They're moderate towards labor in the sense of willing to improve welfare benefits, willing to change things that workers complain about within the factory. But they do not like unions either. In other words, no part of this power structure likes unions. And the reason we've had unions, I'm convinced, is because of the power of workers in the industries that have unions. One of the things that, that I think is very important to understand about the Reagan administration is that I believe that the kinds of people I've characterized as moderate conservatives are basically the people running that administration. People like George Shultz, like Donald Regan, like Caspar Weinberger, like Baldrige at, Malcolm Baldrige at Commerce. They are basically what I call moderate conservatives. The people in the second and third level positions in the Reagan government are ultra conservatives. But then you say, well, look at the labor policies. The labor policies are very conservative because unions are less powerful now. The moderates like the idea of stomping on these unions, but they couldn't do it in the past. See, you couldn't stomp on unions in the Nixon administration, not because Nixon was friendly to unions, but because in the face of the unrest in America, his whole appeal was to hard hats. These are the true Americans. He wasn't going to attack unions when he was trying to build them as a base against these awful students who were demonstrating. But now we have a different situation that Reagan faces. We have a time of peace and quiescence within our country. Maybe there are people grumbling. There are certainly people becoming poor, and I think that's a tragedy. But there's nobody disrupting America. So, and furthermore, there's no war going on out there somewhere. And furthermore, there is the internationalization of production that has led to an enormous number of jobs going overseas, which has decimated the steel union, the auto union, and some of the other. In that context, you can go get the union. And that's why I think Reagan is doing it. Not because he's more conservative than these previous administrations, but because the situation has changed in such a way it's now possible to go after the union.
Would you say also it's because that there is no big union uprising or like there were back in the early 1900s and the 30s? Mm-hmm. And the labor struggles are essentially over as far as the labor hierarchy is concerned. Yeah. So they've even brought them into some of these elite organizations that you've been talking about.
That's absolutely
the Trilateral Commission.
Right. It's absolutely true that the leadership of the AFL-CIO is invited to sit on the board of a Rockefeller Foundation, is invited to be in these discussion groups like Trilateral Commission or Council on Foreign Relations. I think that some of that is definitely part of the picture. But it's more like once there are unions and we've got to live with them, then we'll talk to these guys. But we're certainly not really accepting them. And if the time comes that we can undercut them further, we sure will. And
that shows the flexibility of the ruling class, that if there is ferment from below, if there is a challenge to the system, they will retrench and give a bit so they can maintain their control. But just as soon as the opposition is weak, then they'll push it back. And
that's my view about the moderate conservatives. That is, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And when there was a real disruption in American society, starting with the civil rights movement, then the anti-war movement, ghetto uprising, they were willing. And I mean
they were forced to.
Yeah, they were forced to. Then they were willing. Mm-hmm. to have a family assistance plan, for instance. Mm-hmm. They were willing to see better health care, national health care. These were actually programs advocated by this organization called the Committee for Economic Development. But when the unrest went away, the policy position of the Committee for Economic Development changed in this much more conservative kind of way. I think it's an important kind of flexibility that means that the possibility of reform keeps the system stable. You see, what's implied by your comment, which I agree with, or I claim is implied, is that for these people...
Well, I got it from your book anyway.
No, no, but the most important issue is power, yeah. is control. In other words, absolutely. If I'm going to make a few million dollars less for a few years, okay, but I want to keep my situation, I want to keep the general system running. You see, in the face of unrest, there is another possibility. You can put all the people in jail. You can repress them. You can do very negative kinds of things. And there are sometimes people that advocate those kinds of solutions.
And there are laws in the books which would permit this if the government decides.
But it doesn't work very well. I mean, often it evokes more unrest,
right.
more rebellion.
It has that possibility. But even in the middle 1930s, and here I'm jumping to a time of extreme labor unrest, and perhaps the most militant time that there were, that there was only a short kind of window of opportunity, to use the common parlance, of that when sit-down strikes were legitimate in the minds of most Americans. Within a year or so of those sit-down strikes, the public opinion was opposed to them. Even in the 1930s, I think that a majority of American people were still rural, small-town workers, the white-collar workers. They were not crazy about the union movement. I think that very conservative of solutions could have been enacted against the union movement if there had been a different administration, if there had been a Republican administration, if there had not been Democrat administrations in Michigan and Pennsylvania. I think we would have had continued conflict in those labor struggles. And I say that in the context of the fact that after U.S. Steel was organized, after General Motors was organized, then they, in the case of the Steelworkers Union, they went into Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio to try to organize Little Steel. And they did not succeed. There were many people killed and jailed in Ohio. Every labor organizer that they sent into Ohio was put in a jail at one time or another. Yeah. And it was not until World War II, when Roosevelt said, we've got to stop this labor strife to fight this war, that those steel companies were organized. And one of them never.
Well, it seems to follow logically from your analysis of the power structure that the only way that progressive political change and reform can come in the United States is through political struggle from below,
yep.
in which the power structure is forced to make certain concessions mm-hmm. and certain reforms to stop unrest from growing into outright rebellion or revolution,
right.
that they themselves are not so generous
right.
or beneficent or pro-labor, that if you don't have a strong union movement, strong social movements, and agitation, actual struggle for change, mm-hmm. the power structure is going to rule on unopposed and do more or less what's in their interest,
yeah,
which is often against
right.
everyone else's.
No, they're
interest.
Going to continue to go through their routines. From the way we as sociologists talk about that point is in terms of the question of disrupting people's routines. That is, basically, a society is organized in a set of institutions and roles in such a way that people can go about their everyday business. What that means in terms of people watching this program, they can get up in the morning and they can go to school, they can look forward to graduating, they can say, okay, I'm able to get a job, I'll be able to have a family, I'll be able to have my vacations, my weekends. Living in that ordinary life is very compelling. It draws people into those routines. For anything to happen to lead to change, there has to be in some way a disruption of those routines. And I'm using that very generally because if we look at what happened that changed America in the 30s, it was a massive disruption of a non-union America by this incredible depression. Unions were a very small matter in the 1920s. But when this economic system would no longer work and people were thrown out of their routines, they started to vote and then when they voted Democrat. They started to organize unions. But it was that disruption and sit-ins. You know, we get very concrete. One of the key dramatic elements in the early 1937, right at the start of 1937, was a sit-in in a General Motors factory in Flint, Michigan, which meant the capitalists could not go through their routines. They could not go in and get these cars made. And the sit-in movement then flashed across the country in all kinds of other factories and really gave this tremendous impetus to the union. But now let's look at the 60s. The 60s led to a lot of changes, not because of labor disruption, not because of economic failure, but first of all, because of the fact that there had been created a small black middle class in the South that wanted to insist that the country live up to its liberal values. And how did they do it? They did it at the key point by disrupting people's routines. They sat down in lunch counters and said, "We will not move. We shall not be moved." And that sit-in movement once again spread to buses, to all kinds of facilities where people sat in, and they disrupted the lives of these people. They could not, in Birmingham, for instance, they boycotted the downtown. They marched through the downtown. Now, no longer can you just go downtown and shop. Can you go to your office? You got to worry something going to happen. The anti-war movement did the same thing. The anti-war movement disrupted the routines of administrators, of faculty, indeed of the likes of Secretary of Defense McNamara. He could not go to Harvard and collect his honorary degree because there were people out in the streets protesting, jostling his car, hissing and booing, and so on. That is what makes things happen. Now, I'm not advocating by this, say, for instance, violence. I'm describing. And I happen to believe personally that the best kinds of disruptions are nonviolent direct action. But I'm saying, but stepping back from, you know, my advocacy there, again, into the role of describer or analyst, is what I'm saying is that when we do see change, what we see is in some way people's routines have been disrupted. And what will cause that is economic dislocation, wars. Sometimes it'll be some kind of an accident that will disrupt people's routines, a major oil spill, a major radiation accident.
Or a nuclear accident, right? Like we're seeing now in the Soviet Union, may force people.
Right. It forces people out of their routines. And also in the face of these accidents, what happens that's very interesting in terms of our normal everyday beliefs is that an accident makes it very hard to manage the news. Mm-hmm. You know, tremendous amount of what comes across the media is when a spokesperson for the State Department or the president or whatever stands up at this carefully staged press conference and tells us what's happening or is going to happen. The corporation releases a statement saying we're now going to build this kind of car or whatever. In the face of an accident, they can't sort of get their viewpoint, they can't get their line together, and often will unravel for them, and we get a very revealing picture than of a power structure in the face of a break in routine. And of course Watergate was a nice example of that. And finally we end up, of all things, with the tapes of Richard Nixon's conversations in the White House. Now that was over an accident. When a man that wasn't supposed to be arrested was arrested, you lie about it, you don't have your story real straight, and that leads to another thing, and it just kept unraveling in this wonderful kind of, in that case it was a disruption in their levels. Right. And it spread in a way that then gave us this incredible information about how the power structure operated. Another example of the way in which disruption is important, but also we learned much about the power structure, involves Daniel Ellsberg, who was a policy analyst for the Defense Department and had worked for a think tank called the RAND Corporation, had often been an advisor to major policymakers at these discussion groups. Ellsberg was from a union family, but had gone on to go to Harvard and become this big expert. But in the face of the anti-war movement, it rekindled in him, he reported, his feelings of his background. And he decided that the war was so wrong that he was going to reveal the origins of this war by putting the Pentagon Papers out in the general public. And so, in a word, we learned this amazing detail of the fact that of how the whole war policy was made, of the fact that they were saying one thing and doing another. In other words, they knew the problems they were going to have winning that war at the very time they were saying it was going to be a lead pipe cinch. So, but Ellsberg just wasn't somebody that suddenly decided to give these papers out. It was only the disruption in the society that gradually got to him, in terms of kind of stripping away the veneer that he had learned, that made him then re-identify with people that were struggling in the society. So accidents, scandals, break routines, and major social disruptions, like a civil rights movement or a ghetto uprising, which involves the massive movement of black people from south to north. That was one of the largest migrations of a people in history in such a short time. And that unsettles a social system. Here are people that were basically rural people and farm people, all of a sudden in inner cities, in another atmosphere, namely in the north. And that was a disruption of those cities, partly, mostly because, of course, the white people didn't like it, and then there was all the white flight. At any rate, that's what then creates the opportunities for people to battle with these power structures. And in that context, the moderate conservatives are willing to bend. And in that sense, we get reforms in our system.
Which may be lost later.
Which very definitely can be lost later, and that's the kind of the story of what's happened with the Reagan years. That is, the disruption is gone, patriotism is back, there's no wars. In that context, the conservatives then all of a sudden talk about how, well, these were just liberal experiments. These were just a bunch of intellectuals trying out ideas. In other words, they totally ignore the fact that that these things were all done in the face of real pressure. And they are, of course, trying to undercut all those programs.
Let's turn now to the local level. What is the difference between the power structure on the local and the national level, and the differences between the possibilities for individual participation and impact locally and nationally? Okay.
I think that local power structures are rooted not in large corporations that produce a product, which is where the national power structure is rooted, but rather local power structures are rooted in real estate, in land, in development. At the local level, we have what we like to call a growth machine. At the national level, we have a power elite rooted in large corporation. At the local level, we have a growth machine that's rooted in the attempt to increase the value of land. And what they want is growth, and which intensifies the use of their land. Now, that means then that we have to look at a complex of landowners, developers, real estate salespeople, and so on, and mortgage banks, savings and loans tied around ground development. That's what happens at the local level. The key issues to a local power structure are the water board, the parking and transportation board, the planning board, the zoning board. That's the real politics for local power structure. The other issues are, for them, symbolic, some of the things that concern other citizens. But the local power structure is concerned with growth. Now, the local power structure does relate to the national power structure in a very important way. And that is that what a local power structure tries to do is to attract national capital. That is, they try to prepare the land, their area, so it will be attractive to the new building, the new high-rise building that General Motors wants to put up somewhere. So we try to, as a local city, they try to say, look, we have the cheapest land that you could want, we have a very nice and docile labor force, we have low taxes. So all these local growth machines compete with each other to try to get the General Motors factory, the Exxon office building, or more generally, the new campus of the University of Texas. They try to get the new Defense Department installation. Because if you bring one of those major capital kinds of structures into your city, it will mean new jobs for people, it will mean then more money, more spending for the local retailers, and you will then, your land will be valuable because now the local retailer is making more money, so you can charge him more rent on the building that you've rented him. So I think that's really important to understand that the land-based nature of local power structures versus this more capital-based nature, totally capital-based nature of the national power structure. I've just then suggested that there's a lot of commonality between them, that they have reasons to work together. But you also must understand that there's tensions between them, because if, say, the labor force becomes very radical in a given city, General Motors might say, okay, we're leaving. We're going overseas, or we're going to Tennessee. And that, at that point, they can leave behind a broken local growth machine. So the local growth machine often finds itself angry with national level capital when it leaves. So there's tension between them as well as cooperation. Now, it's also important to understand that at the local level, the primary tension is created between the growth machine as it attempts to expand and the rest of the people who are trying to live their lives in their neighborhoods. At the national level, we have a lot of conflict between the owners of corporations and other people as workers. As workers, we want more wages, which, of course, from the capitalist point of view, is inflationary. We want various kinds of benefits, which from their point of view might make us lazy and not work as hard, and so on. So we have a capital-labor tension in national politics that underlies a lot of the fights over welfare and inflation and so on. But at the local level, the fight is between a growth machine and the rest of us who, as neighbors, as living in a neighborhood, the growth machine's tendency is to move out and move into neighborhoods, either to put in office buildings or to put in apartment buildings. That is, say you're living in this nice, wonderful neighborhood, you've bought this house, all the people have these, you know, single family dwelling, and in comes the growth machine because there's more people now, and they can make more money if they put a big apartment building in the middle of your little area, and you don't like that. The constant fight is between then the growth machine and neighborhoods. And that really animates city politics. Now, this conflict can be very liberal or it can be very reactionary. That is, that sometimes neighborhoods are protecting themselves from toxic waste, from tremendous overcrowding, and a liberal person can certainly understand that and identify with that kind of, with the neighbors in that conflict. But other times, the conflict is such that it's very reactionary because the neighbors are trying to keep out minority people. Or they are, in essence, saying, we don't want a more dense zoning because we like having our two-acre lot. But by having a two-acre lot, they're making housing prices more expensive for everybody in the city. So, in other words, you can't then find enough land to build houses for people of more average income. So what I'm then saying is that you have to look at this constant conflict between the growth machine and neighborhoods, but at the same time, you don't necessarily say one side is going to be more, or that the neighborhoods are going to be progressive. Now, what then happens in local politics is that some neighborhood issue will come up. That is, in some way, the growth machine will encroach upon a neighborhood. They're going to put a bigger freeway in, they're going to put a high rise in, they're going to put a factory that belches smoke into the neighborhood in. One of those, they're going to put a noisy installation in. The neighborhood will be incredibly galvanized. It will fight. But once the fight is over in their neighborhood, they tend to lapse back into their ordinary routines. And of course, in terms of something I said earlier, you can now see my generalization about disruption. Mm-hmm. People go into action when their routines are disrupted. And if I live in this nice, idyllic neighborhood, and now there's going to be this smelly smokestack plant, or this noisy office building, or a big freeway right near my house, you've disrupted what I see as my routine existence, you see. Or you've now overcrowded this school, or for some people you've put minority kids in this school by building this new neighborhood. You've disrupted what I saw as my way of life, and I become an activist at the neighborhood level. But once my neighborhood is taken care of, I tend to lapse back into quietude once again. So in a city, at different times, we'll see different neighborhoods in action.
Meanwhile, the structures and organizations, institutions of the local power structure remain intact and remain in basic control.
Right, and they're usually, of course, rooted in the Chamber of Commerce, but there's usually some watchdog tax organization. There's also some real estate association. There's also, at the national level, incidentally, an organization called the Urban Land Institute that does the think tanking for these local growth machines. These local growth machines have committees of the Chamber of Commerce that parallel the government committees. That is, for instance, for the Planning Commission, there's also a committee of the Chamber of Commerce that looks at planning. So they have a whole parallel structure to go alongside the government. And usually what happens then, incidentally, is that a person is legitimated as a city leader by being a president of the chamber, by being the head of its planning committee, and then that person then runs, then, excuse me, that person then gets appointed to the planning commission. Then after he or she has been on the planning commission for a while, which then legitimates them as a city servant, they then run for city government. In one city in Northern California, in a larger study that was done by political scientists of 10 or 15 Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area city, they had the most wonderful process. I mean, these people had such a lock on the whole thing, it was outrageous. And that the way it worked was, you'd appoint the person to the planning commission. Midway, and then, you had your people on the city council. Midway through the person on the city council's second term, it was a two-term limit in that city, midway through the person's second term, they would resign. And the person from the planning commission would be appointed by the rest of the city council to the city council. That person would then 2 years later run as an incumbent for the next term, and then of course do his resignation after he won his second election 2 years. So you had a process then that everybody that was running was always an incumbent by means of appointment. But you can see the process from, you're a local growth machine member, you get involved in a chamber committee, you get appointed to the planning commission, and then you run for city council. That's sort of the ideal career from the local power structure.
Santa Cruz, though, where you live, have a progressive city council. How were people able to counter this sort of machine or power structure politics?
They seem to have been able to maintain it a while.
Right, they have been, but the important thing to understand is that where there have been successful challenges to the growth machine, there has been very great environmental concern coupled with, usually, student politics. That is, when the University of California was brought to Santa Cruz by the growth machine as the perfect complement to the tourism industry, Santa Cruz is on the wonderful, beautiful beach, and its main thing for the growth machine is tourism, which means it doesn't want any dirty industry spoiling it. But the university was a clean industry, high-level, springing in students. You get that state budget. It was a great coup for that local growth machine to get UC Santa Cruz. Okay. And also, furthermore, the university runs in the winter, and tourism tends to run in the summer. It was perfect. But the university was put inside the city limits for water hookups and other minor kind of reasons. But the university is a giant Trojan horse inside the growth machine, because once this 18-year-old vote was put in, the growth machine has not won a single battle in Santa Cruz. They wanted to expand northward on the coast with a big freeway, and they would have taken in huge ranch lands that would have become 40, 50,000 people. It's all going to be park. They wanted to expand their amusement area on a beautiful piece of land. It was stopped by the environmentalists in the city, plus the student vote. So I think that the answer in Santa Barbara, in Santa Cruz, in Davis, California, with progressive governments, is student vote. But right over the hill from where I live is Palo Alto, California. And in that particular city, the growth machine has also been stopped in good measure. But there you have to understand that the people that it was a suburban town, and the people who live in that town are well-to-do people, and it's their neighborhood. And they fought off the growth machine in that town by getting experts to do a study which showed that the developable land, which was on these foothills, that was actually cheaper for the city to buy that land and put it in preserve than to pay for all of the infrastructure that would be needed to develop that land. You see, the standard line of the growth machine is that it's very good to have development because it will create more jobs and bring in more taxes. When you do a cost-benefit analysis, it often is the case, but not necessarily always, that it costs more to bring in this new growth to ordinary citizens than they really do get out of it. So in some places, the growth machine has been stopped. There's also a wonderful if I may use the word, a dialectic that goes on between the growth machine and a neighborhood, because the growth machine will create a new community. And they'll build all these houses, and the people will be very happy, and everything's lovely. But as you get more and more people in the city, at a certain point, the very city you've created as a developer rises up and says, you are going to spoil what you originally promised if you bring more people. And then all of a sudden there's a vote against the developers, and they are stopped. So that kind of conflict happened. Progressive governments. Now, I want to say one other thing related to this growth machine business that's outside of a city level. It shows how how different the disruptions can be. Santa Monica, California also has a very progressive government. What happened there was, it was a city of little single dwellings. Very nice little city on the coast. Had some well-to-do, but a lot of it was middle class. A new freeway was developed in the late 60s, I believe it was, called the Santa Monica Freeway. And what that freeway did was make it possible for Santa Monica now to be a bedroom community for lots more of L.A., which was a very attractive possibility because of smog. That meant that the land in L.A., in Santa Monica, was now tremendously more valuable if you put high-rises on it. So Santa Monica was dramatically transformed into this community of these huge apartments. Now, once you have these people in these apartments, then of course you want to charge them maximum rent. And in the context of the 70s, their rents were going up like crazy. And some of these people were retired people, and they were middle-level people. What happened was that some progressive people moved to that city, and they said the sensible issue to organize this city around is rent control. And they went out and ran a rent control initiative. Now, the first time they lost, but then something called Proposition 13 happened in California that controlled property taxes. Part of winning that, part of the growth machines in California winning that Proposition 13 was to promise their renters that they wouldn't raise their rents because now property taxes would be lower. But in fact, rents went up the following year in Santa Monica, and the progressive politicians went back at another growth rent control initiative, and this time they won overwhelmingly, plus their candidates won for city council. But the politics of Santa Monica have to be understood in terms of a very dramatically, rapidly changing a situation for the growth machine, in which it had realized fantastic values thanks to this freeway, put up all of these apartment buildings. But once they started to really raise the rents on these people, the people rebelled through rent control. So rent control became the device through which the growth machine was controlled.
Disruption, struggle, etc. And then we see the power structure moving in again with a media blitz in later campaigns, putting a lot of money in getting some of these progressives out.
Some of them.
So it's a constant sort of struggle.
Right. And in the case of Santa Monica, where I think the progressive politicians were very far-sighted, very clever about this, and had the kind of theory we're talking about that allowed them to anticipate, they said, where are these growth machine people going to strike back at us? They said they're going to strike back on us talking about crime, about more police and so on. So the next program that the progressives developed was one around a progressive way of dealing with the question of crime and prevention of crime and so on. And in essence, what they did was to take away every issue that the growth machine tried to use to beat them. At a certain point, what happened in Santa Monica that again shows this flexibility is that the developers would come to them and say, okay, we want to develop certain things. What do you want? And they'd say, well, we'll let you build a building here if you put a park over here, if you put childcare over here, and if you put some low-income housing over here, we'll let you develop it. So the big developers would cost it out, and they'd say, okay. The smaller developers would say, it's blackmail. It's blackmail. They were angry. But you know what? Today, I just read this in the last month or two in New York Times, 60-70% of American cities are now doing that very kinds of, quote, blackmail with developers. They're saying, you're going to develop? Okay, you're going to pay for the school, you're going to pay for the new roads, you're going to put a park over here, you're going to put some low-income housing over here.
I wonder if Austin's doing this yet.
No, we aren't that progressive.
Maybe we have a lesson to learn from
this. Yeah, that's the way, I mean, the developers will accommodate to that. See, here's the dynamic of America. The power, because of our history and our ideology, the way the economic system worked, tremendous amount of power is lodged then in these private economic institutions, developers, landed interests at the local level, capital, big corporations at the national level. The only thing that other people can do is to gain some measure of political power that forces these economic powers to, in some way, accommodate. When you have in Santa Cruz, you see where progressive and liberal people have political power. What they use that for is to then make trades with these business people to bring amenities to the cities. Just recently, the two sides cut a deal in which the downtown business community and the tourism industry agreed to accept with no fight an amusement tax. But that amusement tax is going to be used to fund social services in Santa Cruz that would probably be lost if these Reagan cutbacks go through, the ones that are currently being debated in Congress, and certainly were eliminated. Reagan proposed getting rid of all these support services. So we're able to be able to get these social kinds of services. And as I say, you can allow them to build certain kinds of things if they'll do it in an environmentally sound way, and if they'll also build other kinds of things. And so you have this irony of where we're getting sort of public amenities, but not through taxation, which our ideology in America generally is such that it's very hard then to tax anybody, including these people, and to go after taxing them directly, they can often then use that against you. But if you say, we'll let you develop this if you give us the following amenities, it works.
Well, Bill, you've got a lecture coming up here in a few minutes at the University of Texas. We want to thank you for it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've enjoyed it greatly. It's been a lot of fun.
And it seems to me that the basic to a lot of what you were saying all the way through is that we do have an American power structure, but the people have to struggle and organize and demand and put pressure on it, because otherwise it's liable to do a job on it.
Americans are all liberals in a classic sense, whether they think of themselves as Republicans or Democrats. And we have to constantly build on that liberal tradition, use that liberal tradition, and use it against the power structure. It's part of our culture. There's a history of activism at various levels of our country. There's America's basically, if I put it this way in closing, America's a conservative country with a liberal ideology in which, at various times, we get these chances. And what you have to do is make hay when those chances come, like in the 30s or like in the 60s. And I think it'll come around again, and then the trick is to be there basically demanding as much democracy, as much civil liberty as you possibly can, all of which are perfectly legitimate things to ask for in the United States of America.
So that's the end of part two, and therefore the conclusion of this interview with Dr. Domhoff. I very much hope that you found this as interesting as I did. As I say, I think there's a lot in there that is helpful both from an historical perspective, but also useful for the contemporary situation as we try to make sense of this increasingly mad world around us. So lastly, I hope to be back on track next week with our interview with Reverend Israel Ulawale Olofinjana. I think I've got that right. Looking at the concept of reverse mission and the black majority churches. Then in the following week, we should be chatting with David Haggith of the Great Recession blog about the prospects for a cashless society. Thereafter, in terms of scheduling, I'm not absolutely sure, but we have many interviews in the pipeline with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, Dr. Robert Bennett, Tom Gailey again, and Mark Antonacci on the Turin Shroud, actually. And in fact, I have a pile here of about 13 books waiting to be read by various people who I hope to speak with in the coming weeks and months. So I'm not going to go into all that now, except to say that there's still a lot to come on The Mind Renewed, and I hope that you'll keep checking in whatever way you do, in fact, check in to catch what's going on here as we go forward. So that is it for today. Thanks very much again for tuning in. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future.